This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. My name is David Allen Greer, and this is The Known World. Over the summer, I received an invitation to speak at a conference on citizen cyber science. This sounds interesting, I asked. What is it? Oh, it's very new, they said. It's something where we use software to engage thousands of people in large experiments or in the analysis of data. This is very interesting, I said. I've never heard of it. Well, it's new, they said. Well, what do you want me to speak on? The reply was somewhat quizzical. It's history, they said. When the conference finally convened, there was plenty of history. We met at an old and ancient and revered university with lots of distinguished alums who have contributed much to science. Many have not only received the Nobel Prize, but they have also done foundational work that remains the mainstay of our scientific practice. As the conference unfolded, however, I began to realize that it contained several different themes which are common to the education and practice of science today. How do we get more people involved? How do we convince them of the rightness of our views? How do we bring them over to our side? And that leads us to today's podcast, which is entitled The Confident and the Curious. Becky stood in the front of the room where the corpse would have been placed. A long wooden table was all that remained to remind the audience that the auditorium had served for nearly a century as a laboratory for human anatomy classes. The ring of seats at the front of the room would have been reserved for senior professors. The concentric circle of benches that climbed the room's steep ramp would have seated the students, future doctors all. Only the seats in the uppermost corners of the room might have been open to the general public. For a nominal fee, the curious and the confident could have watched as a learned scholar of anatomy peeled away the skin and exposed the inner structure of a recently executed felon for all to see. Becky, of course, is neither a fresh corpse nor a bloodied professor of anatomy, as both have moved to more modern classrooms. She is a worker of miracles, a middle school teacher who can instill enthusiasm for science in the mind of 14-year-olds. Such creatures can be hard cases, as they are often only a few short steps away from becoming corpses themselves, a fact that I know from a year-long apprentice as a 14-year-old boy myself. Yet, the real miracle is not fitting the 14-year-old into science, as we so often try to do, but fitting science to the 14-year-old. We live in an age of rising concern over scientific education and the next generation of scientists and engineers. As a consequence, we have established more opportunities for 14-year-olds to engage the scientific community. Becky has been more than ordinarily effective in exploiting those opportunities. She has made contacts with one of the large physics laboratories, taking her charges to visit the lab, to talk with the scientists, and even encourage the students to think about questions and experiments of their own. The result of this effort has been a student-designed satellite, which will be launched within the next 2 years, at least according to schedule. The satellite, called LUCID, we all have acronyms. This one is the Langton Ultimate Cosmic Ray Intensity Detector, harkens back to the original American satellite, the Vanguard 1, illustrating the extent to which science has become a massive human endeavor that requires new ideas to fit it into the complex, well-established structure. The LUCID project involves 10 schools in Becky's region of the UK, dozens of students and teachers, and a special detector designed by the Global Laboratory, a space agency, and finally, aeronautical engineers from the US and Europe. The satellite itself is a CubeSat, a standard design that California Polytechnic and Stanford universities created to provide an inexpensive way to get experiments into space. Due to the accelerated development schedule of most CubeSat projects, explained one of the early research teams, students are exposed to seeing the end result of their work from concept to application. This valuable experience gives students an idea of the big picture, or a complete mission cycle, and the whole system of the spacecraft. CubeSats have a standard design, 10 centimeters on a side, and standard systems. They also have a standard deployment mechanism, the PolyPico Satellite Orbital Deployer, or PPOD, if you want the acronym. Satellite deployment is one of the tricky bits of engineering that terrestrial scientists often overlook. You just don't shoot it up into space and let it go. You have to push it away. A giant spring was supposed to push the original Soviet Sputnik away from its booster. The Russian scientists were so proud of their design of the spring that they put a duplicate on display in the Russian Science Museum. Although in the process, they forgot to note that the original might not have worked quite as they had anticipated. Finally, CubeSats also offer a systematic approach to assembling documents, export licenses, and formal approval. To most scientists, this step is usually a jumble of paperwork and exercise and administrative trivia, as they like to call it. However, it is really the step of fitting science into society, of being responsible to the people that pay the bills. If we are building a machine in one country, fitting it to a rocket in a second, and launching it over the heads of the residents of a third, we owe the world a formal statement that the work has been well done, or at least done to standards that we believe will minimize the chances that the rocket will fall on those trusting heads. For all of their clever innovations, CubeSats are a fairly conventional way to engage the public in the work of science. They're an educational tool, a means of teaching potential scientists about the means and methods of research. An equally common method of engaging the public has been to utilize the labor of individuals to gather or to process large amounts of data. Even in the early 19th century, we can find reports of networks of individuals recording natural phenomena, such as the group that gathered tidal data on the coast of England for William Whewell, a contemporary of Charles Babbage, who lived from 1794 to 1866, or, as another example, the original weather observers who collected data for the United States Navy in the 1850s. For both of these groups, the work was hard and exacting. The weather observers, for example, had to be familiar with scientific instruments, collect data at four specific times during the day, complete a detailed form, and place that form in the mail so that it would reach the Central Weather Office, located in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Some individuals have argued that these large data collection efforts could also be used as educational tools, but as a whole, scientists have resisted this opinion. They're attempting, after all, to do good science and would prefer to minimize the risks that training incurs. One of the largest sponsors of mass science in the 20th century, the Works Progress Administration of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, clearly stated that its job had nothing to do with education. Our work is restricted in general to projects involving the collection, tabulation, or analysis of data, wrote Administrative Director Harry Hopkins. And our projects were evolved principally for the purpose of providing employment for needy persons with professional or technical training. In recent years, we have seen the growth of this kind of mass science through the use of the BOINC, an acronym that refers to the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing System. The BOINC software system lets individuals donate the work cycles of their home computer to a scientific project that needs large computing power. It is a form of grid computing, although a fairly simple example. A user first downloads the basic BOINC software and chooses a project to support. Then the Boink client retrieves a computational task from the project's central server and performs that task while the owner is not using the machine. It finally then transmits the result to the central server for collection and organization. An early version of Boink was first deployed in 2005 for the SETI at Home project. SETI, the name is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, looks for patterns in electromagnetic radiation that might have been caused by intelligent life. The methods of analysis are fairly straightforward, as they're drawn from the field of signal processing. However, each method requires a substantial amount of computing, and each is applied to very large data sets. SETI researchers originally developed their own software but shifted to Boink for all the reasons that we have for accepting standard software. It was simpler, easier to deploy, and ultimately more flexible. SETI at Home was the first of many projects to use Boink to handle scientific computation. The Boink software now supports projects that fold proteins, sequence genes, test software, factor large integers, look for large primes, and search for that still elusive, solvable Sudoku puzzle which has only 16 preset numbers or clues. In case you're interested, current research has found numerous solvable Sudoku puzzles that have 17 clues, 17 numbers written in the square. And they have found one 16-clue puzzle that has two unique solutions. An anxious world of problem solvers awaits the results of this work, which may find the minimal and perhaps hardest Sudoku puzzle. Each of these projects has created a community of supporters that follow the progress of research, volunteers more computer time when it is needed, wears the t-shirt, and defends its own. Even with this kind of communal participation, Boink projects have a boundary of expertise that is contained in the software. The volunteers are not really actively involved in the research. The calculations are done in the background and are invisible to the user. While the volunteers are given credit for the computer cycles they donate to the work, they cannot really connect their contributions to any specific result. It's difficult to make that connection for several reasons. First, following the grand pattern of scientific computation, each task is run on at least two computers to check the result. No one can claim a unique connection to any single scientific calculation. Second, as we all know, scientific results rarely depend on a single number. No one but Archimedes runs naked from the bath with a single insight into the scientific problem. Scientific discoveries are made by hypothesizing, analyzing, synthesizing, reasoning to a conclusion, and finally, verifying the results. While we would like to think that we could follow the progress of scientific research on our computers and cheer that a new discovery has been made, we all know that such cannot happen. Our ability to follow the progress on our computers is not only linked to the drama of scientific discovery, but also to our willingness to volunteer our computers for service in search of knowledge. When a group of Boink users gathers for a meeting, they often dwell on specific questions. How can we get more people involved? How can we build a bigger Boink grid system? The question is often phrased in terms of persuasion or education. How can we teach people that this effort is in their best interest? People, indeed, probably do need to be taught that research is in their interest, just as researchers could better recognize that such research involves a form of economic decision-making. What do volunteers receive in return for downloading a strange piece of software and offering their computing cycles? They once received a cool screensaver, but such things consume computing power and are no longer part of the Boink system. Only some will be satisfied with the notion that their computer is doing work. More will be pleased to be part of a community that's dealing with grand questions. Certainly there are those who will be satisfied with the t-shirt, especially if it has a really cool logo. Some would be pleased to receive actual cash for their computer time, but that's outside of the current structure. No one is particularly interested in building a volunteer structure that pays for scientific calculation. There are other ways to get regular systems that involve money. A powerful way of getting individuals involved with an activity is to give them a stake in the work, offering them an opportunity to make decisions about tasks. In situations that employ systems such as BOINC, such a suggestion faces two pretty obvious objections, the first professional and the second managerial. Professionally, we make strong divisions between scientists and workers. We allow scientists the opportunity to make judgments about experiments and data, but do not offer the same opportunities to non-professional workers. We claim, probably rightly, that our judgments are based on scientific training and do not allow others to make those decisions until they have had that training. Managerially, we find that expanding the ability of individuals to make decisions about the work can slow progress. If any basic principle governs the decision-making process, wrote Herbert Simon, it is that each decision should be located at the point where it will be of necessity approached as a question of efficiency rather than a question of advocacy. Because an organization of amateurs cannot guarantee decisions of efficiency. If anything, they probably guarantee decisions of curiosity. It would seem that if we are to expand scientific projects that involve large numbers of ordinary citizens, we must be prepared to accept the consequences of either unscientific judgments or inefficient strategies. During the past couple of years, the scientific projects that involve help from the general public have begun to coalesce into a body of activities that has taken the name of citizen science. Citizen scientists circulate newsletters, operate discussion groups, and occasionally hold conferences in university auditoriums that once served simultaneously as research laboratory, anatomy classroom, and entertainment for the public. Such a setting is appropriate, as this movement often attempts to recombine by means of the internet the three elements of university activity: education, research, and service to the public. It seems that far too often, these three elements are relegated to their own isolated location. Education to the classrooms, research to the laboratories, and public service to those dramatized TV shows about engineering problems that we find so prevalent on those far and unwatched reaches of basic cable television. Citizen science may not be able to make major changes to scientific institutions, but it should be able to occupy some niche in scientific practice, as we have seen in other activities that attempt to coordinate the contributions of the general public with the internet. These efforts have a way of disciplining work and overcoming the gross inefficiencies associated with mass labor. Mass labor, especially when it is a volunteer effort, can prove to be remarkably resistant to discipline. Volunteers are prone to follow their own inclinations, no matter how much guidance a professional scientist might offer. One of the major citizen projects devoted to recording biodiversity claims to offer a global perspective on flora and fauna, but its volunteers have demonstrated a remarkable ability for recording plants that come only from wealthy districts, shopping areas, and the kinds of resorts that are frequented by the well-to-do. Hawaii and Miami and Yellowstone frequent its pages. These things can be of great interest, but when you're looking for pictures of flora and fauna in Cameroon, you will find little of use on this site. As Becky will tell you, every miracle worker knows that certain tasks will never engage a 14-year-old, no matter how important they may be. Sudoku is a puzzle that holds the attention of adults. Regardless of the importance of that search for the elusive 16-clue puzzle, it's unlikely to win the attention of any individual who spends most of their time with computer games that offer fast cars, big guns, and ever-present danger. To engage such people in the dedicated work of research, you need a satellite and a rocket, although a corpse might do in a pinch. Above all, you need a miracle worker who can give the public a stake in the science. You have been listening to The Known World. This podcast was based on an essay that was published in the October 2010 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer the magazine and Computer the Society can be found at www.computer.org. More about this podcast can be found at www.computer.org/theknownworld. That last bit is all one word. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. And if you have any comments, which we would love to hear, you can send them to podcasts@computer.org. I need to tell you that the music for this podcast came from the Music Alley PodSafe Network, which you can find at musicalley.com. And we thank them very much. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.